full energy, incapable of fatigue. She forgot the troubles she'd caused him at the moment when she forgot the troubles of her own that had prompted her. But he no longer controlled her. Did he know that? Had he willed it all? She felt as sorry for him as she had sometimes felt for Abe North and his ignoble destiny. Sorry as for the helplessness of infants and the old. She went up, putting her arm around his shoulder and touching their heads together, said, "Don't be sad." He looked at her coldly. "Don't touch me," he said. Confused, she moved a few feet away. "Excuse me," he continued abstractedly. "I was just thinking what I thought of you. Why not add the new classification to your book?" "I have thought of it. Furthermore, and beyond the psychoses and the neuroses, I didn't come over here to be disagreeable." "Then why did you come, Nicole? I can't do anything for you anymore. I'm trying to save myself. From my contamination? Profession throws me in contact with questionable company sometimes." She wept with anger at the abuse. "You're a coward. You've made a failure of your life, and you want to blame it on me." While he did not answer, she began to feel the old hypnotism of his intelligence, sometimes exercised without power, but always with substrata of truth under truth, which she could not break or even crack. Again, she struggled with it, fighting him with her small, fine eyes, with the plush arrogance of a top dog, with her nascent transference to another man, with the accumulated resentment of years. She fought him with her money and her faith that her sister disliked him and was behind her now, with the thought of the new enemies he was making with his bitterness, with her quick guile against his whining and dining slowness, her health and beauty against his physical deterioration, her unscrupulousness against his moralities. For this inner battle, she used even her weaknesses, fighting bravely and courageously with the old cans and crockery and bottles, empty receptacles of her expiated sins, outrages, mistakes. And suddenly, in the space of 2 minutes, she achieved her victory and justified herself to herself without lie or subterfuge. Cut the cord forever. Then she walked, weak in the legs and sobbing coolly, toward the household that was hers at last. Dick waited until she was out of sight. Then he leaned his head forward on the parapet. The case was finished. Dr. Diver was at liberty. Chapter 10. At 2 o'clock that night, the phone woke Nicole, and she heard Dick answer it from what they called the restless bed in the next room.
"Oui, oui. Mais à qui est-ce que je parle?"
"Oui."
His voice woke up with surprise.
"But can I speak to one of the ladies? Sir, the officer?" "They are both ladies of the very highest prominence. Ladies of connections that might cause political complications of the most serious.
It is a fact, I swear to you."
"Very well. You will see."
He got up, and as he absorbed the situation, his self-knowledge assured him that he would undertake to deal with it. The old fatal pleasingness, the old forceful charm swept back with its cry of, "Use me!" He would have to go fix this thing that he didn't care a damn about, because it had early become a habit to be loved. Perhaps from the moment when he had realized that he was the last hope of a decaying clan. On an almost parallel occasion, back in Domler's clinic on the Zurichsee, realizing this power, he had made his choice. Chosen Ophelia. Chosen the sweet poison and drunk it. Wanting above all to be brave and kind, he had wanted even more than that. To be loved. So it had been. So it would ever be, he saw, simultaneously with the slow, archaic tinkle from the phone box as he rang off.
There was a long pause. Nicole called,
"What is it? Who is it?"
Dick had begun to dress even as he hung up the phone.
"It's the post of police in Antibes. They're holding Mary North and that Sibley Beers. It's something serious. The agent wouldn't tell me. He kept saying, 'Pas de mort, pas d'automobile.' But he implied it was just about everything else."
"Why on earth did they call on you? It sounds very peculiar to me."
"They've got to get out on bail to save their faces. And only some property owner in the Alpes Maritimes can give bail."
"They had their nerve."
"I don't mind. However, I'll pick up Ghost at the hotel."
Nicole stayed awake after he had departed, wondering what offense they could have committed. Then she slept. A little after 3, when Dick came in, she sat up stark awake, saying, "What?" as if to a character in her dream.
"It was an extraordinary story," Dick said.
He sat on the foot of her bed, telling her how he had roused old Ghost from an Alsatian coma, told him to clean out his cash drawer, and driven with him to the police station.
"I don't like to do something for that Anglaise," Ghost grumbled.
Mary North and Lady Caroline, dressed in the costume of French sailors, lounged on a bench outside the 2 dingy cells. The latter had the outraged air of a Briton who momentarily expected the Mediterranean fleet to steam up to her assistance. Mary Minghetti was in a condition of panic and collapse. She literally flung herself at Dick's stomach as though that were the point of greatest association, imploring him to do something. Meanwhile, the chief of police explained the matter to Ghost, who listened to each word with reluctance, divided between being properly appreciative of the officer's narrative gift and showing that, as the perfect servant, the story had no shocking effect on him.
"It was merely a lark," said Lady Caroline with scorn. "We were pretending to be sailors on leave, and we picked up 2 silly girls. They got the wind up and made a rotten scene in a lodging house."
Dick nodded gravely, looking at the stone floor like a priest in the confessional. He was torn between a tendency to ironic laughter and another tendency to order 50 stripes of the cat and a fortnight of bread and water. The lack, in Lady Caroline's face, of any sense of evil, except the evil wrought by cowardly Provençal girls and stupid police, confounded him. Yet he had long concluded that certain classes of English people lived upon a concentrated essence of the antisocial, that, in comparison, reduced the gorgings of New York to something like a child contracting indigestion from ice cream.
"I've got to get out before Hossein hears about this," Mary pleaded. "Dick, you can always arrange things. You always could. Tell him we'll go right home. Tell him we'll pay anything."
"I shall not,"
said Lady Caroline disdainfully.
"Not a shilling. But I shall jolly well find out what the consulate in Cannes has to say about this."
"No, no," insisted Mary. "We've got to get out tonight."
"I'll see what I can do," said Dick, and added, "But money will certainly have to change hands."
Looking at them as though they were the innocents that he knew they were not, he shook his head.
"Of all the crazy stunts!"
Lady Caroline smiled complacently.
"You're an insanity doctor, aren't you? You ought to be able to help us. And Ghost has got to!"
At this point, Dick went aside with Ghost and talked over the old man's findings. The affair was more serious than had been indicated. One of the girls, whom they had picked up, was of a respectable family. The family were furious, or pretended to be. A settlement would have to be made with them. The other one, a girl of the port, could be more easily dealt with. There were French statutes that would make conviction punishable by imprisonment, or, at the very least, public expulsion from the country. In addition to the difficulties, there was a growing difference in tolerance between such townspeople as benefited by the foreign colony and the ones who were annoyed by the consequent rise of prices. Ghost, having summarized the situation, turned it over to Dick.
Dick called the chief of police into conference.
Now you know that the French government wants to encourage American touring. So much so that in Paris this summer there's an order that Americans can't be arrested except for the most serious offenses.
This is serious enough, my God.
But look now. You have their carte d'identité.
They had none.
They had nothing. 200 francs and some rings. Not even shoelaces that they could have hung themselves with.
Relieved that there had been no carte d'identité, Dick continued. The Italian countess is still an American citizen. She is the granddaughter. He told a string of lies, slowly and portentously, of John D. Rockefeller Mellon.
You have heard of him?
Yes. Oh, heavens, yes. You mistake me for a nobody?
In addition, she is the niece of Lord Henry Ford, and so connected with the Renault and Citroën companies. He thought he had better stop here. However, the sincerity of his voice had begun to affect the officer, so he continued,
"To arrest her is just as if he arrested a great royalty of England. It might mean war."
"But how about the English woman?"
"I'm coming to that. She is affianced to the brother of the Prince of Wales, the Duke of Buckingham.
She will be an exquisite bride for him.
Now we are prepared to give,"
Dick calculated quickly,
1,000 francs to each of the girls, and an additional 1,000 to the father of the serious one. Also 2,000 in addition for you to distribute as you think best."
He shrugged his shoulders.
"Among the men who made the arrest, the lodging housekeeper, and so forth. I shall hand you the 5,000 and expect you to do the negotiating immediately. Then they can be released on bail on some charge like disturbing the peace, and whatever fine there is will be paid before the magistrate tomorrow, by messenger."
Before the officer spoke, Dick saw by his expression that it would be all right. The man said hesitantly,
"I have made no entry because they have no carte d'identité. I must see. Give me the money."
An hour later, Dick and Monsieur Gosse dropped the women by the Majestic Hotel, where Lady Caroline's chauffeur slept in her landaulette.
"Remember," said Dick, "you owe Monsieur Gosse $100 apiece."
"All right," Mary agreed. "I'll give him a check tomorrow. And something more."
"Not I."
Startled, they all turned to Lady Caroline, who, now entirely recovered, was swollen with righteousness.
"The whole thing was an outrage. By no means did I authorize you to give $100 to those people."
Little Ghost stood beside the car, his eyes blazing suddenly.
"You won't pay me?"
"Of course she will," said Dick.
Suddenly, the abuse that Ghost had once endured as a busboy in London flamed up, and he walked through the moonlight up to Lady Caroline. He whipped a string of condemnatory words about her, and as she turned away with a frozen laugh, he took a step after her and swiftly planted his little foot in the most celebrated of targets. Lady Caroline, taken by surprise, flung up her hands like a person shot as her sailor-clad form sprawled forward on the sidewalk. Dick's voice cut across her raging,
"Mary, you quiet her down, or you'll both be in leg irons in 10 minutes.
On the way back to the hotel, old Ghost said not a word, until they passed the Jean Lapin Casino, still sobbing and coughing with jazz. Then he sighed forth,
"I have never seen women like this sort of women. I have known many of the great courtesans of the world, and for them, I have much respect often. But women like these women, I have never seen before."
Chapter 11. Dick and Nicole were accustomed to go together to the barber and have haircuts and shampoos in adjoining rooms. From Dick's side, Nicole could hear the snip of shears, the count of changes, the voilas and pardons. The day after his return, they went down to be shorn and washed in the perfumed breeze of the fans. In front of the Carlton Hotel, its windows as stubbornly blank to the summer as so many cellar doors, a car passed them and Tommy Barbant was in it. Nicole's momentary glimpse of his expression, taciturn and thoughtful and, in the second of seeing her, wide-eyed and alert, disturbed her. She wanted to be going where he was going. The hour with the hairdresser seemed one of the wasteful intervals that composed her life. Another little prison. The coiffeuse, in her white uniform, faintly sweating lip rouge and cologne, reminded her of many nurses. In the next room, Dick dozed under an apron and a lather of soap. The mirror in front of Nicole reflected the passage between the men's side and the women's, and Nicole started up at the sight of Tommy entering and wheeling sharply into the men's shop. She knew with a flush of joy that there was going to be some sort of showdown. She heard fragments of its beginning.
"Hello? I want to see you."
"Serious?"
"Serious. Perfectly agreeable."
In a minute, Dick came into Nicole's booth, his expression emerging annoyed from behind the towel of his hastily rinsed face.
"Your friend has worked himself up into a state. He wants to see us together. So I agreed to have it over with. Come along."
"But my hair, it's half cut."
"Never mind. Come along."
Resentfully, she had the staring coiffeuse remove the towels. Feeling messy and unadorned, she followed Dick from the hotel. Outside, Tommy bent over her hand.
"We'll go to the Café des Alliés," said Dick.
"Wherever we can be alone,"
Tommy agreed. Under the arching trees, central in summer, Dick asked,
"Will you take anything, Nicole?"
"A citron pressé."
"For me, a demi," said Tommy.
"The black and white with siphon," said Dick.
"Il n'y a plus de black and white. Nous n'avons que le Johnny Walker. Ça va."
She's not wired for sound, but on the quiet, you ought to try it.
"Your wife does not love you,"
said Tommy suddenly.
"She loves me."
The two men regarded each other with a curious impotence of expression. There can be little communication between men in that position, for their relation is indirect and consists of how much each of them has possessed or will possess of the woman in question, so that their emotions pass through her divided self as through a bad telephone connection.
"Wait a minute," Dick said. "Donnez-moi du gin et du siphon."
"Bien, monsieur."
"All right, go on, Tommy."
"It's very plain to me that your marriage to Nicole has run its course. She is through. I've waited 5 years for that to be so."
"What does Nicole say?"
They both looked at her. "I've gotten very fond of Tommy, Dick." He nodded.
"You don't care for me anymore," she continued. "It's all just habit. Things were never the same after Rosemary."
Unattracted to this angle, Tommy broke in sharply with,
"You don't understand, Nicole. You treat her always like a patient because she was once sick."
They were suddenly interrupted by an insistent American of sinister aspect, vending copies of The Herald and of The Times, fresh from New York.
"Got everything here, buddies," he announced. "Been here long?"
"Cessez cela! Allez oust!"
Tommy cried. And then to Dick,
"Now no woman would stand such buddies,"
interrupted the American again.
"You think I'm wasting my time, but lots of others don't."
He brought a gray clipping from his purse, and Dick recognized it as he saw it. It cartooned millions of Americans pouring from liners with bags of gold.
"You think I'm not going to get part of that? Well, I am. I'm just over from Nice for the Tour de France."
As Tommy got him off with a fierce,
"Allez-vous-en!"
Dick identified him as the man who had once hailed him in the Rue des Saint-Anges 5 years before.
"When does the Tour de France get here?" he called after him.
"Any minute now, buddy."
He departed at last with a cheery wave, and Tommy returned to Dick.
"Elle doit avoir plus avec moi qu'avec vous."
"Speak English. What do you mean, doit avoir?"
"Doit avoir? Would have more happiness with me."
You'd be new to each other.
"But Nicole and I have had much happiness together, Tommy."
"L'amour de famille,"
Tommy said, scoffing.
"If you and Nicole married, won't that be l'amour de famille?"
The increasing commotion made him break off. Presently it came to a serpentine head on the promenade and a group. Presently a crowd of people sprung from hidden siestas lined the curbstone. Boys sprinted past on bicycles. Automobiles jammed with elaborate betasseled sportsmen slid up the street. High horns tooted to announce the approach of the race, and unsuspected cooks in undershirts appeared at restaurant doors as around a bend a procession came into sight. First was a lone cyclist in a red jersey, toiling, intent and confident out of the westering sun, passing to the melody of a high chattering cheer. Then three together in a harlequinade of faded color, legs caked yellow with dust and sweat, faces expressionless, eyes heavy and endlessly tired. Tommy faced Dick, saying,
"I think Nicole wants a divorce. I suppose you'll make no obstacles?"
A troop of 50 more swarmed after the first bicycle racers, strung out over 200 yards. A few were smiling and self-conscious, a few obviously exhausted, most of them indifferent and weary. A retinue of small boys passed, a few defiant stragglers. A light truck carried the dupes of accident and defeat. They were back at the table. Nicole wanted Dick to take the initiative, but he seemed content to sit with his face half-shaved, matching her hair, half-washed.
"Isn't it true you're not happy with me anymore?" Nicole continued.
"Without me, you could get to your work again. You could work better if you didn't worry about me." Tommy moved impatiently.
"That is so useless. Nicole and I love each other. That's all there is to it."
"Well then," said the doctor, "since it's all settled, suppose we go back to the barber shop."
Tommy wanted a row.
"There are several points.
Nicole and I will talk things over,"
said Dick equitably.
"Don't worry. I agree, in principle, and Nicole and I understand each other. There's less chance of unpleasantness if we avoid a three-cornered discussion."
Unwillingly acknowledging Dick's logic, Tommy was moved by an irresistible racial tendency to chisel for an advantage.
"Let it be understood that from this moment," he said, "I stand in the position of Nicole's protector until details can be arranged, and I shall hold you strictly accountable for any abuse of the fact that you continue to inhabit the same house."
"I never did go in for making love to dry loins," said Dick.
He nodded and walked off toward the hotel, with Nicole's whitest eyes following him.
"He was fair enough,"
Tommy conceded.
"Darling, will we be together tonight?"
"I suppose so." So it had happened, and with a minimum of drama. Nicole felt outguessed, realizing that from the episode of the camphor rub, Dick had anticipated everything. But also she felt happy and excited. And the odd little wish that she could tell Dick all about it faded quickly. But her eyes followed his figure until it became a dot and mingled with the other dots in the summer crowd. Chapter 12. The day before Dr. Diver left the Riviera, he spent all his time with his children. He was not young anymore, with a lot of nice thoughts and dreams to have about himself, so he wanted to remember them well. The children had been told that this winter they would be with their aunt in London, and that soon they were going to come and see him in America.
Fräulein was not to be discharged without his consent. He was glad he had given so much to the little girl. About the boy, he was more uncertain. Always he had been uneasy about what he had to give to the ever-climbing, ever-clinging, breast-searching young. But when he said goodbye to them, he wanted to lift their beautiful heads off their necks and hold them close for hours. He embraced the old gardener who had made the first garden at Villa Diana 6 years ago. He kissed the Provençal girl who helped with the children. She had been with them for almost a decade, and she fell on her knees and cried, until Dick jerked her to her feet and gave her 300 francs. Nicole was sleeping late, as had been agreed upon. He left a note for her, and one for baby Warren, who was just back from Sardinia and staying at the house. Dick took a big drink from a bottle of brandy 3 feet high, holding 10 quarts, that someone had presented them with. Then he decided to leave his bags by the station in Cannes and take a last look at Gosse's beach. The beach was peopled with only an advance guard of children when Nicole and her sister arrived that morning. A white sun, chivied of outline by a white sky, boomed over a windless day. Waiters were putting extra ice into the bar. An American photographer from the A&P worked with his equipment in a precarious shade and looked up quickly at every footfall descending the stone steps. At the hotel, his prospective subjects slept late in darkened rooms upon their recent opiate of dawn. When Nicole started out on the beach, she saw Dick, not dressed for swimming, sitting on a rock above. She shrank back in the shadow of her dressing tent. In a minute, baby joined her, saying, "Dick's still there." "I saw him. I think he might have the delicacy to go. This is his place. In a way, he discovered it. Old Ghost always says he owes everything to Dick." Baby looked calmly at her sister. "We should have let him confine himself to his bicycle excursions," she remarked. "When people are taken out of their depths, they lose their heads, no matter how charming a bluff they put up." "Dick was a good husband to me for 6 years," Nicole said. "All that time I never suffered a minute's pain because of him, and he always did his best never to let anything hurt me." Baby's lower jaw projected slightly as she said, "That's what he was educated for." The sisters sat in silence. Nicole wondering in a tired way about things. Baby considering whether or not to marry the latest candidate for her hand and money. An authenticated Habsburg. She was not quite thinking about it. Her affairs had long shared such a sameness that, as she dried out, they were more important for their conversational value than for themselves. Her emotions had their truest existence in the telling of them. "Is he gone?" Nicole asked after a while. "I think his train leaves at noon." Baby looked. "No. He's moved up higher on the terrace, and he's talking to some women. Anyhow, there are so many people now that he doesn't have to see us." He had seen them, though, as they left their pavilion, and he followed them with his eyes until they disappeared again. He sat with Mary Minghetti, drinking anisette. "You were like you used to be the night you helped us," she was saying. "Except at the end, when you were horrid about Caroline. Why aren't you nice like that always? You can be." It seemed fantastic to Dick to be in a position where Mary North could tell him about things. "Your friends still like you, Dick, but you say awful things to people when you've been drinking. I've spent most of my time defending you this summer." "That remark is one of Dr. Elliot's classics." "It's true. Nobody cares whether you drink or not." She hesitated. "Even when Abe drank hardest, he never offended people like you do."
"You're all so dull," he said.
"But we're all there is.
cried Mary. If you don't like nice people, try the ones who aren't nice and see how you like that. All people want is to have a good time, and if you make them unhappy, you cut yourself off from nourishment.
Have I been nourished?
He asked. Mary was having a good time, though she did not know it, as she had sat down with him only out of fear. Again she refused a drink and said, "Self-indulgence is back of it. Of course, after Abe, you can imagine how I feel about it, since I watch the progress of a good man toward alcoholism." Down the steps tripped Lady Caroline Sibley Beers with blithe theatricality. Dick felt fine. He was already well in advance of the day, arrived at where a man should be at the end of a good dinner. Yet he showed only a fine, considered, restrained interest in Mary. His eyes, for the moment clear as a child's, asked her sympathy, and stealing over him he felt the old necessity of convincing her that he was the last man in the world, and she was the last woman. Then he would not have to look at those two other figures, a man and a woman, black and white and metallic against the sky.
"You once liked me, didn't you?"
he asked. "Liked you? I loved you. Everybody loved you. You could have had anybody you wanted for the asking."
"There has always been something between you and me," she bit eagerly.
"Has there, Dick?"
"Always. I knew your troubles and how brave you were about them." But the old interior laughter had begun inside him, and he knew he couldn't keep it up much longer.
"I always thought you knew a lot," Mary said enthusiastically. "More about me than anyone has ever known. Perhaps that's why I was so afraid of you when we didn't get along so well."
His glance fell soft and kind upon hers, suggesting an emotion underneath. Their glances married suddenly, bedded, strained together. Then, as the laughter inside of him became so loud that it seemed as if Mary must hear it, Dick switched off the light, and they were back in the Riviera sun. "I must go," he said. As he stood up, he swayed a little. He did not feel well anymore. His blood raced slow. He raised his right hand, and with a papal cross, he blessed the beach from the high terrace. Faces turned upward from several umbrellas.
"I'm going to him." Nicole got to her knees.
"No, you're not," said Tommy, pulling her down firmly. "Let well enough alone." Chapter 13.
Nicole kept in touch with Dick after her new marriage. There were letters on business matters and about the children. When she said, as she often did, "I loved Dick and I'll never forget him," Tommy answered,
"Of course not. Why should you?"
Dick opened an office in Buffalo, but evidently without success. Nicole did not find what the trouble was, but she heard a few months later that he was in a little town named Batavia, New York, practicing general medicine, and later that he was in Lockport, doing the same thing. By accident, she heard more about his life there than anywhere, that he bicycled a lot, was much admired by the ladies, and always had a big stack of papers on his desk that were known to be an important treatise on some medical subject, almost in process of completion. He was considered to have fine manners, and once made a good speech at a public health meeting on the subject of drugs. But he became entangled with a girl who worked in a grocery store, and he was also involved in a lawsuit about some medical question. So he left Lockport. After that, he didn't ask for the children to be sent to America, and didn't answer when Nicole wrote asking him if he needed money. In the last letter she had from him, he told her that he was practicing in Geneva, New York, and she got the impression that he had settled down with someone to keep house for him. She looked up Geneva in an atlas and found it was in the heart of the Finger Lakes section,
and considered a pleasant place. Perhaps, so she liked to think, his career was biding its time, again like Grant's in Galena. His latest note was postmarked from Hornell, New York, which is some distance from Geneva, and a very small town. In any case, he is almost certainly in that section of the country. In one town or another.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Tender is the Night, written by F. Scott Fitzgerald, narrated by Therese Plummer. Executive producer Kristen Lang, producer Mike Charzik, music by Michael Whalen, mixed and mastered by Darren Vermas. Copyright 1933-1934 by Charles Scribner Sons. Production copyright 2014 by Audible Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.